Have you seen the movie? It's been out for about a month. A Stephen King scary novel called It. Yeah, It is it's a life form that can turn into different things, including scary clowns, and it chases after children. Simply called It. Has no name, it's just It. And in the middle of the night, you're lying in bed in your bedroom, which is where you lie in bed, and you hear this moaning and screaming coming from your basement, and you're actually terrified by a pronoun.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Don't hold on that tight. You're hurting my arm.
Whatever.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It could be any one of those times. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Back, relax, grab a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, whatever your liquid libation may be in the morning, and join us as we take a look at the world around us. As much as it's a pleasure to be with you, the pleasure is actually all yours. And now, here's your host, Ron Van Dam.
Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. That is my name, Ron Van Dam. It's just what people call you. It's not important, really. I am who I am, said Popeye. Something like that. I don't know what Popeye said. I never followed Popeye too much. Popeye was kind of scary to me. You're probably not old enough to know who Popeye is. He was a sailor man, and he worked the docks a lot. And it was a cartoon. It was like black and white. It was old. And he had a very, very ugly, skinny girlfriend named Olive Oil. And there were other characters, too. But Popeye was very skinny, but had these gigantic forearms, like Macy's Day balloon forearms. Pabamsh. He was a very scary character, just like the character in It. Anyway, how you doing today, ladies and gentlemen? You doing okay? You doing all right? You looking good, though, man. Wow, what happened? What happened? Wow, you looking nice. Very, very nice. Okay, today on the program, this is going to be a good show. This is going to be a good show. Are you familiar with the movies Bullet and The Thomas Crown Affair? These were big movies. The Thomas Crown Affair was actually a very popular novel written by Alan Trustman decades and decades ago. And then they called him in to do the screenplay for movies. He joins us today. You know, it was decades and decades and decades ago, still around, and he's written a book called The Pursuit of Happiness. We're going to talk to him and talk to him about all those movies that are iconic, just iconic, ladies and gentlemen. What a man. Okay, how are you, by the way? You good? Everybody good? Great. Let's get started, okay? Okay, you go. Go on, do something. Say something funny. Go on. It's not that easy, is it? You think it's easy to do this day after day? It's not easy. Let's see you do it. Go on. I'll wait. Go on. Make me laugh. Tell me something interesting. Be sarcastic. Go on. Go. Can't do it, can you? Yeah, not so easy when it's on the other foot, ladies and gentlemen. I went to IKEA yesterday. Do you know what that is? It's a gigantic building. It's located in the town of Stoughton, Massachusetts. Massachusetts is a state in the United States of America. It's in the northern hemisphere of North America there. It's between Canada and Mexico, and it's surrounded by a lot of wars. A gigantic island. We call it a continent, but it's a gigantic island, actually. That's what Trump said. And that's where this is, in Stoughton, Massachusetts. And you drive up to the place, and it's like you're driving into another country, because it's huge. You park the car, and then you have to take a five-hour cruise to get to the building. And you walk in, and here's my problem with IKEA, is that it's a Scandinavian kind of weird furniture store. It's as if someone was hoarding in a large building and couldn't get rid of anything, so they put a price tag on it and invited people to come in and take a look. That's what IKEA feels like to me. It's a huge amount of crap. It is. Ron, wait a minute now, man. What are you telling her? I've got IKEA furniture. Oh, I'm sorry. That's a shame. It's about the only place in the world where you walk in and everything you buy, you have to assemble it yourself. Excuse me, you've got the entirely wrong customer in me. I assemble nothing. The worst parts of my life were when I had to assemble furniture. I remember them distinctly. I came near frustration death just putting them together. You can never read the instructions. They're always like, well, it says to do this, but I don't see that. And it says to turn it clockwise. It doesn't turn clockwise. Well, this doesn't fit where it's supposed to. It's just an exercise in frustration. As a matter of fact, I think they do this on person. I'm getting so upset, I can't even talk. They do it on purpose in order to frustrate people. I have never put anything together in its entirety based on instructions. Halfway through, I always say to myself, I'll figure it out. I'll just put the screw over here. Look, it stands up. I'm good. I can't. I don't assemble anything. I just don't. I buy them assembled, or I pay somebody to assemble it. I never want to look at instructions ever again. I can read. I'm a common sense person. Instructions, they're just brain teasers to me. They're like impossible crossword puzzles. So you walk into this IKEA place and very few items are assembled at all. And the prices aren't even really cheap. They're fairly expensive. It's like a double smack in the face. You like this piece of crap here? This is the price. What? That's ridiculous. Yeah. And you have to put it together yourself. Get out of here. Now you're just fooling with me, right? No, I'm serious, man. I'm serious. We just sell the crap. We don't want anything to do with it. You take it, get it the hell out of our warehouse. Get it out of our building. Just take it home and see what you can do with it. No way, man. No way. No way. And here's the problem. When you wander through the IKEA store, it is a maze, and it's not amazing, it is a maze. You cannot get out. There are people walking through that IKEA store back from 1970, I think, still looking for their way out. They're emaciated because they're lost. They just wander around and search. You can't get out of the building, and they design it that way. They design it so once you walk in, you will never leave. I mean, even rats caught in mazes get cheese every once in a while. But you just wander and wonder, where am I? What season is it? Is it winter? Is it spring? I've never seen the outside. I've been wandering here. It's awful. They do have a restaurant, but only when you find your way out. The restaurant isn't in the middle of the building or in the middle of the maze. It's at the end. So it is virtually the piece of cheese at the end of it. And the food, excuse my critique, literally sucks. It's like going to a really bad school cafeteria. And it looks like a really bad school cafeteria. And the highlight of all the food you could possibly eat when you go to a furniture store are the Swedish meatballs. What? Who? Why? Why? Most people like a good hot dog or something, or maybe a waffle or an ice cream cone. They have those too, but not as prominent as the Swedish meatballs. I've never woken up in the middle of the night in an incredibly intense sweat, popping up in bed and going, I gotta have a meatball. I gotta have a Swedish meat. By the way, a meatball is one thing. It's a fine, tasty piece of grease. But we're used to it like with marinara sauce or some type of tomato base. Very few people crave a meatball dipped in cream. It's just not really, not something people really go for. But this is their claim to fame, you know. I think on the side of every large IKEA building, there should be a gigantic cardboard cutout of a meatball. I think that should be their logo. Assemble your own furniture and have a meatball. Who would think that that would work as a business model? But it does, apparently, because you can't get close to this store. On a Sunday morning, cars are lined up for miles and miles to be treated like crap in this large store. By the way, if you want to actually buy something in that store, this is even worse than you'd think it is. If you actually want to buy something in that store, it's not a question of just picking it up and walking out with it. No, they have these little order forms on clipboards, and you fill it out, and then you walk into the warehouse yourself, and you pick it off the shelf. It's phenomenally inconvenient. But yet people go. I'm starting to question my fellow human beings. I really am. And maybe it's me. Maybe it is me. Maybe I'm the one that's the odd person out. But when I talk about these things to other people, they go, Ron, I agree with you. How can you all agree with me, and yet we put up with all this crap, but you all agree with me? How can things be like that? How can you get so many people going into a store, purchasing something that they have to assemble, and find their way out of the maze, and then be taunted with a meatball? I mean, how is this possible? How is it possible? People go to the store called Costco. I've talked about this before. It's a club. It's a membership. You have to show a valid credit card. You have to sign up. You have to give them information. And then you're a club member where they treat you like shit. You walk into the building. You've got to show your little card. That I don't mind. If you're a member, you show your card. I get it. You walk in. You take it off the shelf yourself. You stand in line for 5 hours. And then you leave the building, and they have somebody there to check you out like a TSA agent.
I see that you came from inside the store, and you have a box full of things that you bought.
But you know what? Even though you're a member, I don't trust you at all, you scoundrel little piece of crap. How do I know that as a member you didn't start shoving things into this box, even though you can't get out without passing the cashiers and they would stop you and shoot you on sight if you tried to shoplift something? But on top of it, I'm going to stand at this door and I'm not going to let you out. I'm going to check your receipt against everything that you have in your cart because I don't trust you. Welcome to Costco, member. That's how you treat a member? Like you're crossing the border from Mexico into the United States, which is, by the way, impossible. I don't get it. Yet these are business models that work. I don't understand. Is it just me? What planet did I come from that I wasn't aware of?
I don't get it. I don't get it at all. There's a lot of things I don't get. For example,
he's brought us to the brink of nuclear war, obstructed justice at the FBI, and in direct violation of the Constitution, he's taken money from foreign governments and threatened to shut down news organizations that report the truth. If that isn't a case for impeaching and removing a dangerous president, then what has our government become? I'm Tom Steyer, and like you, I'm a citizen who knows it's up to us to do something. It's why I'm funding this effort to raise our voices together and demand that elected officials take a stand on impeachment. A Republican Congress once impeached a president for far less. Yet today, people in Congress and his own administration know that this president is a clear and present danger, who's mentally unstable and armed with nuclear weapons. And they do nothing. Join us and tell your member of Congress that they have a moral responsibility to stop doing what's political and start doing what's right. Our country depends on it.
Yeah, I agree. And so does 69% of the country thinks he's doing an awful job. 57% of the country think that he's a danger. Why? What's going on?
The Ron Van Dam Show is intended for mature audiences.
Oh, so that's what ironic means.
Yes, honey. Yes, it does.
Okie dokie. We're going to speak to our guest in just a few minutes. I guarantee you it will be spellbinding. You don't have to assemble him. He's already assembled. That's good. That's coming up momentarily. Should be fun, huh?
Whoa!
Yeah, I know. I know. I realize that. I'm being assaulted by leaves. This is the fall, the autumnal festival of life. And at this time of year, the trees shed their leaves. Leaves fall. They're beautiful colors. They're awesome.
Aww.
Yeah, they are awesome.
Whoa.
That's better. And then when they turn to peak of this beautiful color, they all fall off. It's kind of annoying is what it is. And where do they fall? All over my lawn. I have a carpet of dead leaves all over my lawn. Who's going to clean this mess up? Who's going to clean this mess up? Then I have to call a guy. And it's a guy, it's not a girl. I have to call a guy to come over with a ladder and clean these leaves out of my gutters. Yeah, I have to pay for that. These pesky leaves all over my lawn, clogging up my gutters. This has got to stop. Why do we have to go through this? Leaves. Leave me alone, leaves. That was an exciting little dissertation, wasn't it? All right. Our guest joins us. Let's speak to Alan Trustman.
I'm peddling a book called The Pursuit of Happiness, where my hero is a fictional grandchild or grandnephew of people who were in the contract murder business in the 1950s and 1960s.
Okay.
I always wondered what happened to those families afterwards, because they were very good at what they did, and then the business, I think, evaporated, or if it's still in existence, I haven't followed it for a long time now.
So what got you interested in this subject matter?
Well, I lived in Boston through the 60s, and in the 60s, when you had the gang wars, between the McLeans and the McLaughlins. Everybody rooted for one side or the other. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew who was going to get whacked next, and they invariably did. Also, in the 70s, when I controlled High Life, I employed Paul Rico, who had been the head of organized crime FBI in Boston throughout the 1960s.
Wow.
And Paul and I became what I thought was good friends, and I remained in touch with him even after I left the High Life situation.
Wow.
In the 70s, I compiled a history of the gang wars with Paul. I thought I was going to do a movie about it, but I never got to do that, and I never published it.
Oh, wow.
But Paul is gone now, leaving me as one of the few remaining authorities on the Boston gang wars of the 1960s.
I guess so. Which was quite amazing. A lot of people don't realize how intense those wars were.
Yes, 100 people got killed over really 8.5-9 years.
Yeah.
And I remember writing the history. I thought it was a good book, but I never wrote the book, and I never got the movie. And I went out of the movie business before I could pitch it at anybody.
Wow. So for those that don't know, all they know is the Bulger thing nationally.
My Paul Rico is the only person who ever arrested Whitey Bulger before the final arrest. Paul arrested him in 1966 for bank robbery and tried to persuade Whitey to testify against his companions, and Whitey swore up and down he would never, never, never be a fink.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and
there you go.
One of the FBI agents wanted to know if I wanted to testify at the Whitey trial, and naturally I declined. I'm 86, and I hope to keep going.
Wow. Now, is this because your history here of writing is quite prolific, and they are some very intense crime novel, espionage novel kind of situations.
My Bullet, which was really the car chase movie, which I thought would end all car chase movies.
Right.
I wrote that 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I am best known today for having written 2 movies 50 years ago.
Yeah, well, that's fine. But that's good.
I am really enjoying the current press that the industry is getting, which is well-deserved.
Sure.
I have met a number of the people involved. Yeah. They honored me at Cannes 2 years ago, and Harvey was sitting at my table.
Oh, nice.
I wouldn't say, we hardly had anything to talk about because I don't have anything currently going in the business, so I was of no interest to Harvey.
You'd have plenty to talk about now, I guess.
Oh, yes.
The other crime novel that people are very much aware of that we haven't mentioned is the Thomas Crown Affair, which had some incredible legs to it.
That's funny. I just see that as a love story, not primarily a crime novel. Yeah.
Well, yes, it's a love story of that espionage type of involvement. But yes, there was a lot of relationship in there. More than Bullet.
I try to do an American version of the German romantic tradition, the great love of somebody's life, which could never possibly work out.
Right.
And then when they did the remakes, Pierce Brosnan insisted that it did work out.
Yeah.
And they went off together at the end. I was furious.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
They just showed both of them back to back on television this week, and I really enjoyed that. I'd never seen that done before. They showed first the 69 edition, then the 98 edition.
Yeah.
Which was very flattering, and I always like seeing my name up there.
Sure.
I have a big giggle about it.
Of course you do.
No, I was a partner at Nutter McLennan and Fish in Boston from 60 through 69, and I remain very much Bostonian, although my Boston doesn't really exist anymore.
No, it doesn't. Probably not. I understand that your first manuscript, I mean, I don't know if this says anything about you, but your first manuscript you tossed into the ocean.
Oh, when I graduated from college, I went down to Provincetown, and I spent 10 days writing the great American novel. It was wonderful, and then I read it. And I decided it wasn't, and I threw it into the ocean, and I never wrote another thing for 20 years.
You shouldn't be reading your own stuff.
Well, I guess not. I was very disappointed.
Yeah.
And when I did write again, I wrote movies, not novels.
Yeah.
I did try with a novel in 1990, and the publisher went bankrupt the very day that he published the novel. So it didn't do very well.
Wow.
And this year I have written two novels. I wrote a man's novel and a woman's novel. The woman's novel is called Silver Dollar. It's about a small town girl who, kind of a wild one, who goes to New York and enjoys the place for 50 years.
Yeah.
And the man's novel is The Pursuit of Happiness, which I described before, which is supposedly the subject of this interview.
Yeah,
it's very much supposedly a man's novel, and I think any man who picks it up will find it reads very quickly, and there's a lot going on.
Yeah. You know, and we'll talk about that in a second, but I see what draws me to reading a piece or a novel is knowing the author. And when listeners hear about your history and your writings and your works, then when they read the novel, it kind of becomes more significant to them. I don't know if you understand.
Well, I hope so. It's a little bit different type of writing. Mm-hmm. It is not the style that the New Yorker has made the literary gems of the day. There are no descriptions, and there's none of the wordplay that goes on and on. It's all action and dialogue and interior dialogue. The man is a killer, and the interior dialogue is intended to make the reader like him.
Yeah.
I'd like to have him the sort of person that you'd like to bring home and introduce to the family.
Yeah. So it's a novel. It's a novel based on true environment.
Yes. It starts off in a Boston scene.
Yeah.
And then he is working for the government, for the FBI, as a paid killer, and they send him on two missions to the Near East.
Mm-hmm.
Which are very carefully done, and I'm told by people who know both of the locations that they're absolutely accurate.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a rescue in the Caribbean and an ending that I'm very pleased with, and the reader knows what's going to happen in the next chapter, and I've had a bunch of phone calls from people who want me to write it. I think most men who read it will enjoy it and find that it's a very quick read and a very easy read.
Good.
At least I intend it that way. I'm lucky, somebody will pick it up for the movies or television.
Probably will.
Although I'm not sure what they're doing with the movies anymore. They're not my kind of movie anymore.
I understand. Are you working on something else already?
Yeah, I'm working on another love story.
It
will be a movie, and then I have to figure out what I'm going to do with it. I'm way back where I was in the 1960s when I wrote a screenplay and I didn't know anybody in the business. Today I have two remaining friends out in California.
Yeah.
One is Roger Corman, who is 95, and the other is Walter Mirisch, who is 105.
These are big names. Yeah. But still,
big names, but not exactly active in the business anymore.
Active,
although Roger's still making movies.
Yeah, but you've still got the you got the clout there. Have you ever thought of just going directly to motion pictures rather than writing a book first?
Well, my first two were written as screenplays. I never tried to write a novel after my 1952 failure.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote The Thomas Crown Affair as a screenplay, although I had never seen a screenplay.
Right.
And it was in a form I sort of invented, which caused a lot of giggling out in Los Angeles when they scheduled it for production.
Well,
Norman Jewison came to Boston. Uh-huh. I insisted he come to Boston. He taught me how to write a screenplay.
Uh-huh.
So I put it on screenplay form, actually, most of the year after I sold it. The rest is history. You know, it's amazing business. I'm getting $35,000 a year in mm-hmm. royalties
mm-hmm.
from two movies I wrote 50 years ago.
That's all right.
There are very few businesses which keep paying off and paying off and paying off long after you're done.
That all depends on how smart you are in business when you're doing that, though.
I guess. Although I was pretty stupid. I didn't know anything about the business.
Well, I guess they really wanted your product if they were willing to strike a deal like that.
Yeah, well, those are the residuals, thanks to my union.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Got the residuals.
Yeah, very nice.
The story of how I marketed The Thomas Crown Affair has been published. It's in the Atlantic Monthly.
Uh-huh.
The cover story on January of 78 in the Atlantic Monthly.
Wow.
If anybody wants to read it, they can dig that one out. It's available online.
Beautiful.
Are the Patriots going to win Sunday? That's all I want to know. That's my big worry today.
That's your big worry?
That's
pretty good. Every time it seems like they're just mundane, they just kick it up when they have to. That's the way they play.
I thought last Sunday was like real Patriots all over again. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I'd almost given up on them after the early games.
You never know what you're going to get. It's like they don't do it unless they have to do it, which is not the best way of, I guess it's worked in the past for them. I'm not sure. Anyway, sure. The Pursuit of Happiness, Alan Trustman, go pick it up.
Available on Amazon and some bookstores. I don't know which ones are carrying it in Boston.
Right.
But the easiest way to get it is on Amazon.
It's
$5. Books are free nowadays.
Very sweet. Well, it's a pleasure speaking to you. I hope we can do this again. You're fascinating, and I applaud your achievements. Yeah.
You have my number. Call me anytime.
Excellent. Alan, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much, and continued success on your book, and we urge everybody to pick it up.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was fascinating. Thank you so much for being here today. You know, I should have a parting gift for you, but I don't. And if I did, you'd have to assemble it yourself, because I ain't doing it. I'll be back again tomorrow with another show. I hope you join me then. Until then, I do wish you peace. We're all gonna need it.